Hello, and welcome to Talking Global Infrastructure. I'm Matt Dickinson, Head of Communications and Marketing at the Global Infrastructure Investor Association, and I'm very pleased to be joined for this episode by Si McKinnon. Si has a wealth of experience across energy infrastructure assets, having executed $35 billion worth of transactions over the course of his career. He is Equitix's Managing Director for Product Development and Strategy, and among other roles, was previously a managing director in the investment banking arm of Barclays and a director at Credit Suisse. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us today, Si.
Hi, Matt. It's great to be here. And thanks for the invite to join you.
To start us off then, Si, I mean, we touched on the breadth of your experience there. It would be really interesting to hear about how you feel the energy infrastructure investor landscape has changed since you started out in the industry.
Of course. First, it's amazing to me that I can now say I started out in this field over 25 years ago. How time flies. During that time, there really has been quite an evolution in the infrastructure investor landscape. I'd probably divide the evolution of the landscape into three major phases. When I first got involved in energy infrastructure, starting back in the mid-1990s, the space was largely dominated by publicly traded and state-owned utilities and energy companies. Those were the platforms that owned most of the assets. However, over the next 10 years, the public equity market investor base increasingly became more focused on growth and increasingly exhibited less demand for slower growth, but higher yielding companies and assets. At the same time, institutional investors such as pension funds and sovereign wealth funds were becoming increasingly aware of how well these energy infrastructure assets really matched up with their liabilities and their funding requirements, given that these assets are high yielding and have really strong downside protection due to various characteristics. They're highly asset intensive, their revenue streams are very low risk, typically underpinned by strong contracts with highly credible counterparties or underpinned by regulations. And given that, you know, these institutions have long-term liabilities, they really like the strong inflation linkage of this asset class. It's, you know, that's an extremely valuable characteristic to them. So starting out in the early 2000s and really taking off in the mid-2000s before the financial crisis, investment managers devised private fund structures which allowed these institutional investors to acquire infrastructure assets, often acquiring them from the public market platforms or building new infrastructure assets. By holding these assets privately outside the public stock exchange meant these institutional investors' holdings wouldn't be subject to public market volatility and turbulence, and the assets could be managed for the long term. Well, of course, there still are many infrastructure assets owned by publicly traded platforms, but you know, I would say the steady shift of infrastructure asset ownership from publicly listed entities to being privately owned, either directly or indirectly, by an institutional investor base has been a major theme over the course of my career, and particularly the last 20 years or so. Then a bit more recently, particularly, I would say, over the last 10 to 15 years, as institutional investors have gained even more comfort and conviction and appetite for the asset class, they've sought more direct ownership of infrastructure assets. Some of the really large institutional investors have hired their own direct investment teams, and they originate, negotiate, and manage their own infrastructure investments. Other institutional investors have increasingly sought to make direct investments by co-investing alongside their selected fund managers. And that, you know, both of those has been a major trend. And I would say finally, in the last, you know, particularly the last 5 years or so, we've really witnessed a reluctance among that institutional investor base to acquire new assets that would not survive the energy transition to net zero.
Thanks, sir. That's a really helpful overview. And I mean, within that context of the energy transition and the appeal of green assets over recent years. I mean, Equitix recently reached a high-profile agreement with the UK Infrastructure Bank around financing for electricity storage. And I wondered if you could talk us through that as a bit of a case study, the nature of the agreement, and the wider implications of what you're rolling out there.
First, given the UK Infrastructure Bank is only just over 2 years old, it's probably helpful to give a bit of an overview of that institution. When the UK was part of the EU, it helped to fund the European Investment Bank, and UK infrastructure projects could solicit the European Investment Bank for funding and support. Shortly after the UK left the EU, the UK government set up the UK Infrastructure Bank so that that entity could support UK infrastructure projects that were part of UK strategic national importance. The UK Infrastructure Bank was launched a little bit over 2 years ago with a mandate to deploy over 20 billion. I think the number is 22 billion over 5 years across infrastructure projects in the UK, particularly which help the energy transition and also which support regional and economic growth. They deploy this capital in the form of loans, loan guarantees, and equity investments. I believe the UKIB has now made upwards of 20 investments and deployed on the order of 2 billion. So they're off to a good start. In 2019, the UK government became the first nation to make a legally binding commitment to net zero by 2050. And since then, it's mapped out a pathway to achieve this. A key component of that pathway is the government's target of fully decarbonizing the electricity system by 2035, in about 12, 13 years' time. UK is on the journey to achieving that and has really come a long way over the past 10 to 15 years. It now has over 50% of its electricity generated from zero carbon sources. In other words, either renewables or nuclear. But between now and 2035, a tremendous amount of additional power generation capacity has to come from intermittent renewables. In other words, wind and solar. The UK Infrastructure Bank recognized how critical significant additions of electricity storage would be in order to enable all this intermittent wind and solar, not only to act as a bridge between when renewable power is generated and when people don't want to use it, but also to help ensure the stability of the UK grid and its network with all this variable generation. The UK already emerged as a global leader in utility scale battery storage, thanks in large part to a very helpful regulatory framework. But the UK Infrastructure Bank understood that there's a tremendous additional growth beyond what it had already, the country had already installed would be needed over the upcoming decade. And the UKIB wanted to stimulate private investment into new commercial frameworks, technologies, and applications for electricity storage across the country. So in July of last year, the UKIB solicited proposals from various infrastructure investment managers in relation to an electricity storage fund. Their idea was that the UKIB would act as a material anchor investor, and that the investment manager would raise private capital around that and raise a large fund to invest in the space and really install material amounts of capacity for the UK. The UKIB ran a competitive process and in March this year announced that it awarded Equitix a 125 million anchor commitment into our new UK electricity storage fund. In August of this year, we formally closed with the UKIB on the fund and are currently raising capital for it from private fund investors. We're getting a very positive reception for it, both from UK and international investors. It's exciting.
It does sound like a really exciting project, Si, and clearly it's exactly the kind of project we need all around the country to address that intermittency issue that you mentioned there, you know, trying to smooth out where and when power generation happens on the electricity side. Really, really interesting. Couple of things I wanted to draw out of your answer there. I mean, you mentioned that the scale of the ambition in terms of the green capacity that's needed to hit some of these UK government targets that have been set out. I mean, I think it's fair to say we're speaking at a moment when there is a degree of uncertainty about the direction of travel for net zero policy in the UK. We're obviously just off the back of a Contracts for Difference renewable energy auction round, which hasn't yielded any new offshore wind capacity, even though historically that's been a strong area for the UK in terms of investment. How are investors feeling about the UK landscape at the moment, and how optimistic are you about our ability to meet those ambitious targets that you spoke about there?
Yeah, it's a good question, Matt. Touching on some of the points that you referenced, and there was a good number there. I mean, notwithstanding yesterday's news that the UK government is going to be delaying some of its electric vehicle and home heating decarbonization initiatives, you know, I think the latest CFD round with respect to its offshore wind results is providing a real wake-up call to UK government. Additional offshore wind farm developments, kind of given the geophysical and solar radiation relative to wind characteristics in the UK, is really critical and essential to the UK to staying on its net zero pathway. But the politics related to decarbonization is really a very tricky and delicate balancing act. It's interesting. Polling demonstrates strong public support for action on climate change, but polling also reveals that most voters prefer net zero policies that do not impact them personally. So, you know, policies that the government backtracked a bit on yesterday, you know, policies that impact what car you're able to buy next, or policies that require you to place your boiler in the home, they have a very direct impact on consumers. It's a very tangible impact. Setting higher contract for differences strike prices in an auction round is a lot more abstract. And of course, depending on what happens to the market price of energy, higher strike prices can end up raising consumer energy bills, but it's a much more indirect and opaque cost to the consumer than things like what car you can buy or having to replace your boiler. So politically, I think it comes with much less risk while still making a really important and critical decarbonization contribution. Related to the last CFD auction round, I think within the government there perhaps was a bit of complacency or maybe hubris as a result of the huge success of the prior auction rounds. And somehow the inflationary pressures being felt by the offshore wind sector, you know, particularly with respect to construction costs, and within that, you know, perhaps construction labor in particular, were somehow not fully appreciated. Even though there were warning signs, such as a couple of months ago, I think it was in July, when Vattenfall pulled out of a large UK offshore wind development that they'd already sunk very significant capital into, because the project was no longer economically viable as a result of these inflationary pressures on the construction side. I think it's unfortunate the government missed these warning signs with respect to the latest auction round, but having said that, you know, I think getting that political balance right, this is an area where, you know, perhaps politically it's easier to react and set policy and incentives to allow continued investment, to allow the UK to remain on a viable pathway to net zero by 2050. So I think the UK will react positively to that, you know, notwithstanding some of the noise and the government picking its battles in terms of where it chooses to be more proactive or more assertive in its policies to really stimulate the investment and progress the energy transition.
And in terms of stimulating investment, I mean, how do you feel that the UK compares to other markets in Europe and elsewhere? Do you see any nations that are doing a particularly good job of crowding in private investment that the UK and others can learn from?
Yeah, I mean, certainly everybody now is talking about, you know, the US IRA, the US Inflation Reduction Act, and, you know, the other stimulus acts put through by the US just after COVID, you know, that really set forth an industrial policy that the Western world, at least, you know, probably hasn't seen since World War II. And, you know, I think Europe and the UK are trying to figure out how to react to it. And those pieces of legislation certainly have attracted a tremendous amount of capital investment in the infrastructure space into the US, sometimes to the detriment of Europe. But I think it was really an extremely special set of circumstances which allowed the US to pass such massive investment stimulus into the space. You know, at the time, both the executive branch and all the legislatures, you know, being of the same party, that's a major rarity in the US. And then combined with that was the COVID crisis, is what allowed this pretty remarkable set of stimulus to be passed. And, you know, really the moon and the stars were perfectly aligned for that. And, you know, I suspect in the US we may never see that again for quite some time. I'd be surprised if the US had the political will to continue at that pace of stimulus in the sector. You know, I think the balance of power has already shifted. And while it's, you know, definitely a huge shot in the arm for the decarbonization of the US, you know, a significant portion of the tax credits related to that act are now already spoken for, and there's been a significant investment spike, but will it be able to be sustained through renewing those incentives? You know, I think is a major question mark. And, you know, I think that the EU is working to respond through its Green Deal industrial plan, and already had some major stimulus plans in place before the IRA was put in place, such as, you know, the EU's Recovery and Resilience Facility, and, you know, it's Ukraine related Repower EU. But, you know, I would say overall, generally, the EU is not in the same place politically where the US was when it passed those acts, and you know, the political landscape is a bit more tenuous, and you know, it seems like UK and EU may not be in that kind of place where there can be some assertive stimulus policy for the upcoming years. You know, many countries are more paralyzed by political divisions, which is also, you know, where the US is back to.
No, that makes sense. And I mean, in terms of thinking about investability, it strikes me that the Inflation Reduction Act in particular has done a lot to increase the viability of the kind of investment you were talking about earlier in terms of battery storage, you know, nascent technologies, areas like carbon capture, hydrogen, EV charging. It's increased the investor appeal of those areas within the US. And I mean, generally speaking, I mean, I heard a member of ours recently sort of describing investment in those areas as more akin to a kind of venture capital approach, where there's high upfront capital required, but a lot of uncertainty around returns. Do you think that's a fair kind of generalization, or is that oversimplifying things?
Yeah, Matt, it's an interesting question. I do understand where the person is coming from, but personally, I think it can be dangerous to make wide-ranging generalizations and lump together all of these newer, and in some cases, emerging forms of infrastructure together as having the same risk profile. I think it very much depends on which technology you're talking about, but also, often of equal or sometimes more important, which specific jurisdiction you're talking about, because the risk profile in different jurisdictions can be drastically different with respect to some of those technologies that you named. For example, the regulatory framework for utility scale battery storage is much more developed and clear in the UK and Italy, but is currently less developed in certain other European jurisdictions. And that results in very different revenue risk profiles for the same technology in different jurisdictions. You know, along the same lines, the risk profile for EV charging platforms can really vary depending on which countries you're talking about. Different countries have very different competitive landscapes for EV charging. Some countries have a relatively fragmented and undefined landscape, whereas others have some very strong market leaders, and other jurisdictions have significant initiatives by national utilities or national oil companies who have a brand recognition, which could be challenging for a startup to compete with. So, you know, I think it really depends on the jurisdiction for EV charging in terms of the risk profile. Sometimes it is, you know, more venture-like, and you know, in other jurisdictions, it's more infra-like. And I would also say that some of these new forms of energy infrastructure have more established end markets than others. Battery storage is, at its most basic level, about buying and selling electricity. And electricity markets are extremely large and very established. With respect to EV charging points, there are now millions of electric vehicles being sold per year worldwide. So there is an essential and growing need for charging infrastructure. On the other hand, I would argue that the depth and breadth of the market for hydrogen is much more nascent and less developed at this current point in time. That's evolving quickly, although it's not to say that, you know, for the right project, that the market risk couldn't be mitigated with very strong contractual framework. And then finally, some of these technologies are more commercially proven than others. The operating histories of carbon capture, underground storage plants, operating at least at a commercial scale, you know, there's much less operating history than technologies like battery storage and EV charging. So some of these have significantly more scale-up risk and operating risk, arguably, than others.
That all makes sense. And to your point about the variation across jurisdictions, it sounds like there's quite a lot more work to do to provide investors with some consistency across markets, you know, even markets that are very close to one another, increasing that consistency so that the case for making these much needed investments is a bit clearer, you know, uniformly around the world. Easy one to finish then, Si. You know, we talked about net zero ambition and targets. It feels like there's, as you've said, you know, in recent years, more and more positive talk about the need to decarbonize and achieve net zero. To what extent, in your mind, is that positive talk turning into action enough in terms of getting us there? Are we building enough greenfield capacity fast enough around the world to meet these targets? And within that context, we're obviously heading into elections across the UK, the US, the EU. What should manifesto writers be thinking about when they're looking at these targets and, you know, thinking about the different ways to crowd in the private investment needed to make those targets attainable?
Yeah, I think on the whole, it is clear we are on a journey to net zero. The question is whether we can get there quickly enough to avoid serious climate change catastrophe. And while it's not always a straight line, there's no doubt that global spending on energy transition technologies and the rollout of those technologies has scaled up dramatically over the past decade. You know, in 2022, I think global spending on energy transition assets was $1.3 trillion, you know, which is probably four or five times higher than it was a decade ago. However, I've seen figures suggesting that to stay on a pathway, you know, 1.5 degree C temperature increase pathway, global investment now needs to exceed $2 trillion a year. and by the end of the decade needs to exceed $4 trillion a year. Last year, some 300 gigawatts of renewables were added globally. That's a huge number, but estimates are some 1,000 gigawatts of capacity needs to be added per year to stay on the 1.5 degree C pathway. You know, these are huge, staggering numbers and are going to take tremendous political will. And I'll repeat my earlier comment that the politics related to decarbonization is really a very tricky and delicate balancing act. And voters in concept have strong public support for action on climate change. But, you know, when those net zero policies directly impact them, you know, that tends to influence how they vote as well. So, you know, with respect to the question about speechwriters and manifestos, you know, I'm a fairly far cry from a political speechwriter, but you know, it seems to me what gets voters to tick your box as a politician on the ballot, and what international infrastructure investors need to see to deploy capital, you know, may be two fairly different things. I would say for infrastructure investors, uncertainty and policy reversals scare international investors away. Clarity and certainty attracts them. Targets without underlying regulation or clear stimulus to make them a reality does not attract investment. You know, investors that are deploying millions or in some cases billions are really going to look for the substance and the political risk associated with those policies. So if you want to attract international investment, it's key that you devise a set of clear policies which are deliverable within of your country's political environment, and then stick to them. However, you know, given that balancing act I referred to before, as a politician, I suspect you might be well served by saving the specifics of the policy until after election day. So that'd be my two cents.
Really interesting, Si, and I think our members would certainly agree with the points you made there about the need for stability, certainty, and the substance of these new policies, particularly around net zero infrastructure investment. And listen, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for joining us today, Si. That's been a really, really useful oversight, particularly on the net zero side, and a huge amount for our listeners to unpack and learn from there.
Well, thank you, Matt, for having me on the podcast. I've enjoyed it.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Global Infrastructure. Thank you very much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe to us on Spotify and iTunes, and follow the Global Infrastructure Investor Association on LinkedIn as well. We'll see you next time.